Josh Bell hates everything.
That's right, including your movie.
Josh Bell hates everything.
Except me.
Hello and welcome to the Josh Bell Hates Everything podcast. I'm Josh Bell, contributing editor and film critic for Las Vegas Weekly. And joining me this week is T.R. Witcher, associate editor of Las Vegas Weekly and also film critic.
Hello. Good to be here.
Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
My very first return guest, so this is awesome. This is quite exciting.
Exciting for me, too.
Yes. And for everyone, the entire listening audience, I'm sure, the vast listening audience.
Waiting with bated breath.
Absolutely. So there's a ton of movies opening this week, actually, and let us start with Blindness, which is a movie that I guess you would call sort of an Oscar bait kind of film in a way. Although the reviews on this movie in general have been sort of negative. It played at the Cannes Film Festival back in May and got quite the drubbing, and actually was rejiggered to a certain extent. There's a whole voiceover narration that was cut out. And it played at Toronto earlier this month, and now is coming out, or in September last month, and is now coming out in wide release. So directed by Fernando Meirelles. He's a Brazilian director. I'm always mispronouncing filmmakers' names here. So anyway, director of The Constant Gardener and City of God, both of which I thought were good movies. Mm-hmm. And this is a different thing for him. You know, those were sort of more political, sociological dramas. And this is a sort of sci-fi thing, I guess you would call it, although with a lot of political, sociological.
Kind of allegorical.
Yeah, absolutely. And stars Mark Ruffalo and Julianne Moore, and basically is about this sort of inexplicable epidemic of blindness, where everyone, or just about everyone, it seems, except Julianne Moore for some reason, in this unnamed city, and presumably the whole country or the world, although we never really figure that out.
Right.
But all of these people go blind. Mm-hmm. And it starts slowly. It's not everyone at once. So you get the one person, and then it sort of snowballs, and they see it as some sort of disease. And so eventually the blind people are quarantined in this sort of – it's like a abandoned
– mental hospital or asylum or something like that.
Right. Yeah. And that's – I think that's probably the bulk of the movie, at least the middle, you know, third or more of the movie, where they're confined in this mental institution.
Right, and it sort of becomes like a Lord of the Flies kind of piece.
Right, with Gael Garcia Bernal plays this sort of megalomaniacal guy who declares himself the king and affords all the food and decides to demand, you know, tribute in the form of valuables or sexual favors from the women. I thought the whole middle portion, I kind of liked it at the beginning, where there was a sort of creepiness to it. All these people are suddenly becoming blind and they don't know why. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of all a bit horrific, although I think I was hoping for it to be more sort of disturbing and scary at that point. Mm-hmm. But once they got in the asylum, I felt the whole Lord of the Flies type thing was a little overwrought. I kept thinking, like, where are the people who've been blind all their lives, who've been able to sort of deal with this, and why can't they help us out?
Right.
You know? And the way that the people were treated was so extreme to me that it sort of was out of proportion with what was really happening. And so I don't know. I felt like this movie was sort of a mixed bag.
Yeah, there were some things that were, you know, when I think back on the movie, I liked it bit more when I saw it than I do now. Some things were just a little bit inexplicable, you know, like you're saying, you know, the government hoards all these people in this asylum, and there really is no explanation given, and that, you know, that seems a little bit more cold-hearted, at least at a kind of an early stage of, you know, some kind of epidemic. You know, where you still feel like in the early stages, kind of like society is still sort of functioning in one piece. And so, you know, it doesn't seem to serve a purpose to be so deliberately neglectful of these folks. You would think there would be, you know, scientists in there trying to examine them. I mean, and maybe that could have gone down its own sort of path of discomfort or horror. But you would think they wouldn't just be kind of abandoned and, you know, shot on sight if they tried to leave. There'd be some kind of effort of these people hold the clue, perhaps, to, you know, solving this thing.
Right, right. I think that was what was disappointing, that I didn't get a sense of, like, how does this affect society or what is really being done. And there's, other than the one sequence where the Danny Glover's character sort of says he's been listening to the radio and he narrates this sort of quick overview of what's gone on outside. But I felt like it was very dissatisfying, and it hinders the believability of the story, mm-hmm. where, like you said, they're just thrown in this one place and we don't really know what's going on.
No, you know, I found I didn't mind the... I thought the movie wasn't going to take that much time in this asylum. I thought it would be more sort of society at large. And right. I was pleasantly surprised by the fact that, okay, instead of trying to, you know, tell this very wide but maybe not very deep story, they were going to try and zero in on this very small community of people. I guess one of my complaints, you know, I tend to be sort of a stickler for points of logic and common sense of
logic
characters.
And I mean, common
once you get past
movies.
Kind of a suspense of disbelief,
yeah.
And, you know, and the pivotal thing is you have Julianne Moore, who's the one person who can see, and
right.
so she allows herself to be quarantined so she can be with her husband,
sure.
Mark Ruffalo, who's an eye doctor, ophthalmologist, and, you know, I didn't have a question with why she was the only one who could see. That was fine.
You just kind of have to buy into that because you don't know why anyone else can't see anyway.
Right. But, you know, as the film goes along and you know, this blind character is sort of tyrannizing all the other blind characters, and he somehow smuggled a gun into the premises, or there are a few handguns apparently floating around, and that's sort of what's allowing him to, you know, tyrannize everyone else. You're thinking, you know, come on, like Julianne Moore can see.
Right.
Like she could, like, take the gun from him and he wouldn't know it. And
sure.
And, you know, as the story progresses and kind of bad things happen, you know, you can't help but sit there and wonder, and it breaks a bit of the spell. I mean, because I think the filmmaking was really exciting and visually, you know, compelling, but it sort of breaks through that work that the director's doing when you're asking yourself, well, why doesn't she just take some action immediately, because she can see and no one else can.
Right.
And
the fact that really it's seemingly no one figured out that she was able to see, even though she's the one who can kind of guide everyone around and make sure that they don't run into things mm-hmm. and figure those things out. So, yeah, that did bother me more than a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also, like, the filmmaking – he's trying hard to represent something on screen that is very difficult to represent, the idea of blindness, obviously. And even though the way they describe it, the characters, is that they're sort of, what do they say, like swimming in milk, you know, it's like a sea of white. So that gives him something to go on. But at the same time, I felt like he was maybe trying a little too hard to make this a visual thing that was a little distracting, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I mean, it's certainly something, you know, it's based on a novel, a very well-regarded novel, which neither of us, of course, have read.
No.
But, you know, something that I think is called unfilmable. And in a case like that, I think you always have to be creative in, like, okay, so if this is unfilmable, what kind of alternative approach can we take to it to make it cinematic and to make it a movie? And he's obviously doing a lot on that front in order to make it work. And I don't know that it necessarily does, but...
You know, I will say some things that I thought worked well for me was the, you know, when everybody first gets into these into this asylum, it has sort of a pretense of order and kind of respectability. And, you know, it sort of descends, and eventually you have kind of people walking around with no clothes on, and the sort of casualness of that I thought was really effective.
Right, that's
you
true.
Know? And,
yeah.
And I had the feeling that maybe an American filmmaker might not have gone in that direction.
Sure.
And I thought that was sort of nicely rendered.
Right.
You know, because, you know, there's a lot of junk and debris on the floor, and people are, you know, trying to sort of take care of themselves, I mean, hygienically and whatnot, but you feel like some things are just starting to slide as they kind of, you know, descend towards the, you know, kind of breaking point, you know, sort of the Hobbesian, you know, like, state of nature where everybody's just kind of after each other.
Right, right.
And so I thought that worked well.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think you're right that sort of casual level of detail was good there in the asylum. I don't think it necessarily worked so much after, I don't know, spoiler alert, they get out of the asylum. And when they go back out into the world. And what I was wondering at that point is, of course, at that point, it looks like any post-apocalypse movie. You know, the streets are empty and there's trash right. blowing everywhere and people are, you know, sleeping in storefronts and whatever.
Right.
And I was like, well, where are all the people? It's not like it was a nuclear holocaust. They just all went blind. They're still alive. Where did they go?
Right.
And I don't know. At that point, again, I think there were some issues of where you suspend your disbelief, but things don't quite add up. And it's not necessarily artistically or evocative enough or whatever to get past all that necessarily. But I did think the acting was good as well. Julianne Moore, Mark Ruffalo.
Yeah,
they were effective.
You know, the performances were good. I would have liked to have seen a little bit more. Danny Glover shows up as a guy with an eye patch.
Right.
He's kind of sort of the old sage. And apparently his character was narrating the film and probably had a larger role. And so here, You feel like the film is trying to, or maybe in some earlier stage, had given him a larger role, and, you know, that role is kind of unfulfilled in this version. But
right.
there's a moment where, you know, he starts to have a relationship, or the beginnings of one, potentially with a character played by Alice Braga. And that actually I thought would have been more interested in their relationship, because she's a
prostitute right.
escort.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's kind of this old man, but they don't really know that about each other per se, or
right.
don't know much about each other because, you know,
they can't see each other, sure.
and I don't know the details that they've shared with each other. But I would have found their relationship a little more interesting than Julianne Moore and Mark Ruffalo. You know, I mean, Ruffalo's kind of emasculated because he can't see,
right.
and Julianne Moore can see,
yeah.
and has to sort of take over, and eventually at some point, you know, she feels some contempt for him, you know, because she has to sort of take charge and do all the courageous things. And
right.
then kind of at the end, he's allowed sort of a moment of, you know, redemption when
right.
he helps her out. I mean, and that was all well and good, but it felt a little less interesting, I think, than what these other two characters, because you don't see those two kinds of characters together as often.
Right.
And, you know, so a few kind of missed opportunities maybe at the edges of the story.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's an interesting tale. I mean, I was telling you when we walked out that there's something to be said for, you know, post-apocalyptic story, which I love.
Oh, and I do too.
Never,
I do too,
I never
yes.
get, you know, and even though we've seen those sort of, you know, empty city streets of the big city, I haven't quite gotten tired of seeing that image because
yeah.
I find it very sort of visually striking.
Right. Sure,
like,
of course it
know.
Is, yeah.
So it was nice to see that in the context of a story that wasn't about zombies and vampires and sort of, you know,
sure.
a little bit more of the traditional science fiction
right,
kind
right.
of.
Although it is, I think, playing off that imagery, especially in that last part when they get out of the asylum.
Yeah, that's true.
You
They're...
really expect the zombies to show up. And there's one point where a bunch of people are converging on a grocery store
right.
To try and find food, and the blind people trying to get in the door. It very much looks like a zombie movie.
Right.
So they're definitely
And there
playing
is one
with that.
Moment when Julianne Moore is in a bit of sort of peril.
Right,
and that's
right.
that's very much evocative of kind of, you know, the flesh eaters are all
sure.
kind of converging.
Sure,
her.
Sure, sure.
But, you know, an interesting movie, certainly, and I look forward to seeing what Morellas does next.
Yeah, oh, I agree. And I do think it's interesting. I don't think it's quite a success. I think I'd probably give it 2.5 stars, you know, kind of right down the middle. But you know, kudos for the effort, I guess. That's
right.
what I would say.
I might give it somewhere between 2.5 and 3, two and three,
two
quarters.
And three quarter stars.
Two
we can we can do
quarters.
Any
okay.
number of stars
Fantastic.
We want on this show.
Fantastic.
So okay, let's move on to a movie I know that you probably have a lot of affection for because I know you're a huge Westerns fan.
Love Westerns.
And this movie is Appaloosa, starring and directed by and co-written by and I believe featuring a song by
and produced by.
And produced. There you go, Ed
Harris. So if you don't like this movie, you know who to send your angry letters to.
And co-starring Viggo Mortensen and Renee Zellweger and Jeremy Irons. And Harris and Viggo, they are a pair of a sort of itinerant lawmen, I guess you would call them.
Sort of like freelance, you know, freelance lawmen, freelance kind of police officers almost, who sort of come to towns who, you know, where the rule of law kind of doesn't exist, or where, you know, bad guys have taken over. There's some bad element, the town can't get rid of them, and they come in and the town pays them a hefty fee. And in the case of this town, Appaloosa, where they arrive, they sort of arrive with some documents that say, you turn the control of the town over to us. And, you know, the town fathers are kind of shocked at having to do this, but the bad guys are so bad that they have no choice. And then Viggo and Ed, you know, promptly get to work,
right,
you know,
and
gunning down all of the
the bad people, right, who are led by Jeremy Irons
right,
as this sort of rancher who's very conniving and evil for reasons unexplained.
Right.
And the other major personage is Renee Zellweger, who shows up in town, and she's a widow, I guess it is,
mm-hmm.
and never really explained why she comes to this particular little town. She shows up seemingly without any money or any prospects, or aside from her ability to play the piano.
Right.
And she and Ed Harris eventually, or not actually, very quickly, fall in love, and then there's some complications, because
right.
basically she's kind of a slut, I think, is the thing. And this is what I thought was interesting. I mean, the Western aspect, sort of the gunfight and the good mm-hmm. guys versus the bad guys stuff, mm-hmm. was very traditional and,
right.
and familiar and,
right.
and executed well enough.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought what was interesting about this movie was it's sort of like women folk ruin everything kind of message, where Renee Zellweger shows up and the previously like completely together, you know, effective gunman Ed Harris
right.
completely falls apart, and his efforts to capture the Jeremy Irons character are eventually thwarted because of his love for Renee Zellweger, and then she goes and betrays him, and then he forgives her,
right.
and really she kind of screws it all up. So
yeah. You know, there's I didn't think Renee Zellweger was particularly well cast in the movie. There was just something about her, something in her face or the way she speaks that just didn't feel well served by this role. But, you know, the character sort of shows up and she presents as this kind of just, you know, damsel and, you know, or just kind of the stock, you know, spinster type who, you know, one of the cowboys, one of the gunfighters inevitably is going to fall in love with.
Right.
And then, yeah, she sort of has this, you know, you call it slut-like,
maybe I was
sluttish
a little harsh.
Demeanor. In my review, I think I obliquely refer to this as her pragmatic survival skills on the frontier, where, you know, she's playing this woman who realizes that what she feels she has to do is sort of ally herself with you know, whoever the strongest man in the town is,
right.
And as that man shifts, as one sort of strong
yeah.
man falls and another kind of rises, you know, she sort of changes allegiances,
right.
which
she's very quick to do so.
Yeah, I mean, and as I'm saying that now, I mean, you know, that feels a little bit, you know, hokey or you know, retrograde even. And yet, I mean, I think there is something, and maybe there's more nuance that they could have played out of this. I think there is something, you know, sort of realistic about, you know, her, you know, or at least the character having some kind of agency where she's feeling like I have to have some scheme, some plan, as
right.
imperfect as it
right.
is, to sort of survive. And so I thought that added some texture to what looked like would have been a pretty, you know, straightforward
yeah.
you know, damsel in distress kind
right.
of.
Yeah, it does, but at the same time, I don't know. I was sort of put off a little by the almost, you know, sexist portrayal of her. And maybe it's accurate because women, of course, didn't have a whole lot of agency or a whole lot of options at that time. And she's more independent than most in that she doesn't have a husband and she comes to this town by herself and she makes her own living playing the piano and so on. But it did sort of, I don't know, sort of rub me the wrong way, I guess, the way that they were reducing her to this sort of base, you know, sexual opportunist.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe if the performance had been a little darker and she had been more blatantly conniving, you could see that.
Right, or just a little bit more, I maybe perhaps willing to kind of cop to it.
Right.
Sort of embrace it. I mean, there is a bit of that, I had no choice, and there is a bit of the taint of kind of, you know, I'm not really in control of the decisions that I'm making, and so maybe if the character had been, you know, written with a little bit more nuance, that might have played better. But, I can't say that I didn't find that somewhat, you know, intriguing.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
I mean, I love Westerns. One of the things I love about Westerns are just sort of the, you know, the big open landscapes and the sense of, you know, space in a Western, where you feel like the stories often are, you know, a little bit simpler. They don't have to rely on people like grabbing cell phones and, you know, I mean, sort of the modes of communication are simpler. And so it feels like the stories have a little bit more room to breathe because they're a little bit more basic in a way. And that often allows the viewer to kind of, you know, push their own imaginative
thing to
bear. And, you know, I mean, for a half an hour, 45 minutes in Appaloosa, it plays it so by the book that it, you know, the line between a cliche and what kind of what's classic is
right,
kind of
it's hard.
Is a thin one.
Yeah.
And everybody maybe comes down on that differently. But, you know, I kind of thought, okay, this is going to have absolutely nothing new, except for the pleasure of kind of Ed Harris and Viggo Mortensen playing these pals and just sort of enjoying this kind of really spare, you know, Western dialogue and, you know, a man's got to do what a man's got to do kind of stuff. And, you know, it's clear the men sort of, you know, love each other or care about each other, but, you know, they are unable or unwilling to
express it,
you know. And I mean, the actors clearly look like they're having a good time.
Oh,
so that goes a long way to sort of smoothing over the, you know, moments where things feel overly familiar. But I thought by the back half, not that there's necessarily anything in the back half that you also haven't seen before, but I felt like the movie kind of, you know, found its stride a little bit more.
Yeah.
And opened up and felt like it was now content to kind of be its own thing rather than simply being a pastiche of of other Westerns.
I think we see Westerns so infrequently nowadays that even when it is just doing what has been done a lot in the past, it hasn't been done that much in the last, you know, 20 years or whatever.
Right.
So it's still sort of refreshing to see something
like
that. So, yeah, I enjoyed it. It's not – I mean, Westerns nowadays I think are either – something like this or like Open Range, the Kevin Costner movie, where it's just like, we're going to do what they used to do and kind of straightforwardly make that happen. Or it's something sort of bizarre and deconstructionist.
Like the assassination of
Jesse James. Or the Proposition, the Australian movie.
Mm-hmm.
And this is definitely in that more traditional mode.
Right.
But again, it's so infrequent that I think I enjoyed it too. I'm kind of neutral on Westerns. I like some, I don't like others, but it is nice to see one being made now, just as it's nice to see like a musical or any sort of genre that's not really trotted out a whole lot. So I would give it probably 3 stars, I think, you know, just enough, and especially if you
agree.
Like Westerns.
I'd agree. Yeah, it's nice. You know, the only thing I wish we could have seen a little bit more of is Jeremy Irons.
Right.
So I think is a really cool actor and sort of playing that kind of classic, like really, you know, despicable, you know, kind of sleazy Western rancher kind of bad guy is something he would have, you know, was trying to sink his teeth into, but they didn't give him didn't give him a lot of screen time.
No.
And I think, you know, he was a little bit underutilized.
That's true. They care more about Renee Zellweger and that relationship, I think, than they do about building up the antagonist to really be menacing. But all right, well, we can move on to another, what I thought was a fairly mediocre movie, How to Lose Friends and Alienate People, which is a play on how to win friends and influence people, based on a memoir by Toby Young, who is a British writer who worked at Vanity Fair magazine in New York for 5 years and sort of stumbled into, I guess, into all sorts of crazy situations. And this is, I think, very loosely based on his book, which I haven't read, but I did read an interview with him recently where he talked about some of the changes they made. And Simon Pegg of Shaun of the Dead plays Sidney Young, as they call him in this movie, mm-hmm. Who's this British writer who shows up at Sharp's magazine, which they call it, run by Jeff Bridges, and who doesn't get a whole lot to do in this movie at all. They don't really, not like The Devil Wears Prada, where they spend a lot of time skewering the famous editor of the magazine. Right. Here, he's right. supposed to be Graydon Carter, who's the editor of Vanity Fair, but they don't do a right. whole lot with that. And mainly, this movie is about Simon Pegg's character falling in love with a coworker of his, played by Kirsten Dunst, who is a character completely made up, was not in the book, and really, it seems like what they've done is taken a memoir, which was probably more about workplace situations and the culture clash between this British guy who ran this sort of underground magazine, mm-hmm. And ends up in the glossy, you know, high stakes world of these sort of fashion-y magazines in New York, where it's all about pleasing celebrities right. and companies and so on. And that idea is kind of sort of limply trotted out, I think, here in favor of the standard romantic comedy stuff. Sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
And I like Simon Pegg, and I like Kirsten Dunst, and I thought they had a decent amount of chemistry. Mm-hmm. But overall, this was just like sort of going through those romantic comedy motions. And there were times, I think, where you could see that sort of satire or that commentary on the world of publishing sort of shining through a bit, but it just wasn't sharp enough,
right.
and it wasn't funny enough, I don't think, right. to achieve that.
Well, you know, my big problem with the movie was that Simon Pegg's character, it was very sort of bipolar for me. On the one hand, they're trying to make him, you know, this pretty despicable, kind of mean sort of guy. And, you know, it made me wonder whether the memoir was quite a bit more acidic
yeah.
than the film. On the other hand, he's sort of also cast as just kind of the, you know, clumsy schlub, you know, who's makes a lot of mistakes but is
lovable.
Basically meant to be likable
right,
and
right.
you're kind of rooting for the guy. And I never really got a feeling for what this character is doing at this magazine, you know,
right.
and maybe, I mean, as a writer, you know, watching a movie about another writer, you want to hear the character like talking about what he wants to write or seeing or
right.
having some
writing
way of
is a very
a sense
secondary
of,
thing in this movie,
you know, but you don't say, I mean, he's meant to be kind of the younger, you know, snappier version of Jeff Bridges' character, who Jeff Bridges once was before he became this kind of big, you know, mogul of New York media. But I never really quite got that vibe that he was this really like sharp-tongued, intellectual, underground
yeah.
guy. In the scenes that they give us in the early part of the movie, I mean, he crashes the BAFTA awards in Britain and, you know, he's he has a chance at a rooftop party to sort of cleverly pontificate, and you know he pontificates on Con Air,
right?
And it's, you know, it's mildly amusing, but it certainly, you don't walk away from that thinking, wow, this guy, this character is really like super super sharp and unbelievably cutting edge in his
right.
humor and sophistication.
Right, he's not sophisticated. At one point they tell you that he has, what is it, like
a master's
degree
in philosophy. And
yeah.
that just kind of parachutes in from nowhere,
right.
and you're thinking, and his father shows up for a minute, and his father is apparently like a well-respected academic, and
right, and he's a pretty useless character. He's
yeah,
in like two scenes.
So either as a character who, I didn't buy him either as a character who had this sort of like really sort of indie cred background, but I didn't really buy him as the, you know, celebrity awestruck guy who, I mean, eventually he kind of makes his pact with the devil because he wants to sleep with a young starlet, and so he has to try and play the game,
right,
the publicity,
right.
which, the tough piece game. And I couldn't quite – I felt that those two sort of notions were at odds, and I didn't really buy either one. So throughout,
yeah.
I just had a hard time kind of getting a handle on really who is
right. –
I mean, I know who they're asking me to think he is, but who is he really?
No.
That didn't work for me very
well. I think
well.
He kind of is whoever the plot calls for him to be at different
at
points
moment.
In the movie, because they have to go through those romantic comedy beats. And yet at the same time, they have to go through the beats, presumably which are more in line with what's in the book, about his career at the magazine and his being at odds with the editor and
right.
being at odds with the tone.
And his integrity.
Which he totally sells out.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think there were bits of it that I thought were funny and were sort of clever, But no, I mean, I completely agree. I think this is a movie that's definitely at odds with different elements of itself, that it's not quite what the book probably was, but it can't completely abandon that and just be a stupid romantic comedy, because they're still trying to sort of make some points about this world or sort of give you some insight into it. And it does seem like sort of a mess. I mean, I think it helps that even if the character is a bit confusing, I think Simon Pegg is always likable. And
yeah, he's
he kind
fun
of carries that along.
I mean, and Kirsten Dunst is, you know, I mean, I feel like she plays this role like every year.
Sure.
But she does well at it. She's adorable,
right.
And she's cool.
Right.
And
you can believe that someone would want to fall in love with her.
Right. Right. You know, it's funny in these romantic comedies where all it takes is sort of like playing like one song on
right.
one album.
And then they
one
have
time,
that connection and
everything is
yeah, it's perfect.
You know, actually the character who I thought was interesting was Maddox.
Oh, the Danny Houston character.
Was the Danny Houston character who was sort of, you know, Simon Pegg's mentor / professional and personal rival. And, you know, that character, the way Houston plays him, I mean, there are moments where he's, you know, he's ingratiating and he has this fantastic smile. And so he has this sort of charismatic, but then he's a snake, but then he's, yeah, I mean, and it's sort of, you know, a typical kind of bad guy kind of role, but there was something about him where I thought, man, I'd like to see more of how that character wound up,
yeah.
know, where he was.
I kind of can't stand Danny Houston as an actor, so I think I probably just tuned him out. I find him incredibly artificial.
What else has he been in?
What is he? He was in Birth, that Nicole Kidman movie. He played her husband. And I'm trying to think. He played a vampire in 30 Days of Night. Actually, I think that was the one thing I've liked him in 30 Days of Night, because he plays this vampire who speaks in this sort of made-up vampire language.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't really tell what he's talking about. And he just looks creepy. But, yeah, I'm trying to think. He was in Children of Men briefly. He was the sort of industrialist who Clive Owen goes to help him get across.
Michelangelo or
right,
something.
Right, and he has the Pink Floyd pig outside his window.
Yeah.
Okay. And
okay.
A few other things. I mean, he hasn't done a whole lot of leading. He was in that John Sayles movie, Silver City. That he actually played the lead role in that. And
okay.
I think that was the first time where I thought, this guy is really annoying.
Okay.
So, yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of him in this movie. But, yeah, there could have been, I think, more interesting stuff that was left in the margins or left on a page somewhere.
But, I mean, but you're right. You know, ultimately, you know, it's an unsatisfying marriage. And so you have to, I think they had to make a decision, which they did not make.
No,
either
exactly.
We're just really going to try and like do this memoir straight. And it was going to be probably a little bit darker and harder edged. Probably not with a happy ending per
right.
se. Although
right.
I guess really it is a happy ending, because now he gets to see his work sort of, you know,
sure, and apparently he's very successful now.
Right.
And I was looking him up on Wikipedia, and he's been on television shows,
mm-hmm.
and he's a, you know, accomplished writer and all
mm-hmm.
this stuff. So, yeah, he's done very well.
Or you're just going to make it a innocuous,
right.
charming
right.
romantic comedy.
Which it doesn't quite achieve either.
Right.
So.
So.
I think the more that we talk about this, the less I like this movie. I might give it like 2 stars
at this point. I would go with you on that.
Yeah. All right. So, well, there's actually, as I said before, there's a ton of movies opening this week, including a few more that I know you haven't seen, but I'll try and go through fairly quickly. Probably the most notable, at least for some slight controversy, is Religious, the Bill Maher hosted documentary directed by Larry Charles, who directed the Borat movie, in which Bill Maher, host of the HBO show, is called Real Time, I think, and he's a stand-up comedian. And he's very anti-religion, and so he goes through in this movie talking to various religious figures and basically just berating them for their stupidity. And I think if you're sympathetic to his point, which I certainly am, and if you find him funny in general, which I usually do, then you can enjoy this movie well enough.
Mm-hmm.
But I think as a documentary, even skewed, but I think even as a sort of opinion piece documentary where he's trying to convince you of something, it's not that effective, because what he does is he takes a lot of really easy targets. There's very few times where he's talking to people who seem either like average people who are just happen to be religious, or religious leaders who have a certain level of intelligence to them. He's talking to a lot of really weirdo extremist people mm-hmm. who are clearly wacky and who I would imagine the majority of mainstream people in their religion would probably distance themselves from.
Right.
And they make for comedy because they're so absurd and he can easily sort of shoot them down.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think it makes him look very petty and mm-hmm. and sort of undercuts his argument, you know, which is that religion is negative no matter what, whether it's practiced by these extremists or anyone else, it's still ultimately detrimental. So I was entertained, and I think I might give this like a 3-star review, but with the caveat that you kind of have to go in wanting to like it, I think, at first. Mm-hmm. And if you're at all religious, I think it probably will only entrench you in your anti, you know, Bill Maher position.
Right.
One movie that I did like, although actually I think I only gave this 3 stars as well, but that I would more recommend is Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, which is a romantic comedy. And actually in a way similar to How to Lose Friends, and then it takes place in New York and among these sort of hip people, much younger people, mm-hmm. sort of high school students with Michael Cera from Juno and Superbad and Kat Dennings. And they play the title characters who sort of fall in love over the course of one night, and it's quite predictable, but I thought it was very charmingly done. It's sort of an 80s throwback to like John Hughes type teen movies where, you know, everything is sort of a fairy tale in New York in this movie. You know, everyone drives and it's very easy and you can always find parking and things like that.
Right.
And this goes along, I think, with that. The whole tone is of a piece with that. But at the same time, the leads are very charming and they have a nice chemistry. And it's one of those movies that you watch and you think like, oh, wouldn't it be nice to be a teenager and fall in love? Even though, of course, in real life, being a teenager is horrible and painful and falling in love is emotionally wrenching. But in this movie, it's all wonderful and very nice. And so I enjoyed that. And then Flash of Genius, starring Greg Kinnear, and a true story about this college professor who invented the intermittent windshield wiper and then had his idea stolen by Ford and went on this long, long, long crusade to get credit for it. And I like Greg Kinnear. He's sort of effective in this movie, but it's a very by-the-numbers, bland Hollywood take on a story that is actually seemingly more sort of complicated and messy than, of course, they streamline it into in this movie. So. Mm-hmm. A disappointment with that one. But I would say go see Nick and Nora this week. That was a fun one. And then on DVD, I will give a quick plug, despite my better judgment, for The Happening, the M. Night Shyamalan film, which was totally trashed by critics and which I also gave a bad review. But I think Shyamalan gets trashed so heavily, so constantly, that he almost deserves a second chance.
Does he?
I think...
Really?
And I don't want to say that this is a good movie because it's not a good movie, but it's an interesting film. I think in a way like Blindness, where I want to give him credit for taking on this sort of hoary sci-fi story and trying to do something different with it and trying to bring his own sense of style, which doesn't work. It's all the acting is very stilted in a sort of artificially obvious way to sort of evoke these old, I think like 50s, like Twilight Zone episodes or sci-fi movies. And it doesn't really work, but there are actually a number of pretty creepy moments, and it's better than, I think, the sort of overwhelming trashing, which is, I think, as much about him and his ego and his persona as it is about whether the movie was any good or not. So, you know, maybe give it a second chance as a rental, you know, now that it's on video, it might be worth, I don't know. But and you can complain to me afterwards. If you hate it.
That's Josh.Bell.
Right, exactly. You can go to joshbellhateseverything.com and, you know, rant away. But, yeah, so I think see Nick and Nora and Appaloosa. If you're a Westerns fan, check that out.
Yeah, I think if you like Westerns, it's this is a nice old school take. And Viggo and Ed are very solid. I mean, I enjoy pretty much everything they do, and they're a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, they definitely get that sort of old school, you know, stoic, you know, manly man kind of thing going for them.
Right.
So, all right. Well, thank you very much to T.R. Witcher for being here.
Thank you, Josh.
And,
always a pleasure.
For Las Vegas Weekly, I'm Josh Bell. Tune in next week.
Josh Bell hates everything!